started. Tony Mulvey.
We're back.
Zach Strickland here for this week's version of Freightonomics, the Baltimore Bridge edition.
Yeah.
As you know, unfortunately, I think most people, anybody that would watch this show would be very familiar with what happened this week with the Dolly container ship running into the, of course, Francis Scott Key Bridge. God, yeah. It's Thursday.
It feels like Friday, but it is Thursday.
Yeah. So, I think most of the questions are obviously around, like, what's the impact? What's the fallout? What are timelines? A lot of these things we don't know yet.
Yeah.
But I think the bottom line, there's some basic things that we're going to cover that lets everybody know who's impacted the most, who's doesn't necessarily needs to watch, but also who needs to kind of keep a side eye on what's going on over there. But first off,
it's time for marketing two first. We got to set the table. So, Zach,
yeah,
in 3, 2, 1.
All right. So, first chart, we've got the outbound tender rejection index. This is a very uneventful chart at the moment. And it's underwhelming. 3.48%, the OTRI value as of today. Looks like it is following right in line with where it was this time last year. Not a great sign for transportation service providers who are expecting a market to turn. We have been talking and thinking the market is going to turn sometime in the near future. I don't know that anybody was really expecting the tender rejection index to start spiking in March. We did think that there could be the potential for a little bit of that spring volume to have a push, but not so fast, not so far. The market is still extremely oversupplied, and the tender rejection index rate being below 3.5% at this point, especially at the end of a quarter, definitely reflective of that. Let's go to the next chart. Much of the same here, the NTIL, the national truckload index, excluding total cost of fuel, spot rates on the floor still crawling. They kind of bounced. We saw this little uptick. If you look at the white line there, it bounced to start the month of March. It's right in line with where it was this time last year. Looks like it's curving around. The rates are still a little noisy to look at because you have mixing that can influence the average rate per mile in aggregate. But same story. The market is still pretty much extremely well supplied. Rates are depressed, but they're not as low as they have been. So next up, let's go to the next chart. The FTI, along with the RTI and NTI, these are the three national spot rate indices for flatbed, refrigerated, and dry van. The big takeaway for me here is that flatbed remains kind of at the top. Van remains at the bottom. The percentage changes, though, overall, and that's what you're looking at, is this relative chart view, is that they're all down year over year. And this includes fuel, which has actually been increasing over the last bit. So all three modes, you know, yes, flatbed in general, higher, as you would expect. Refrigerated, higher. The motion of refrigerated, though, really, really hard downturn.
Yeah. That's the one that kind of stands out, because you're into a period that it's still early for produce, but I mean, you start to see some signs of the Southeast having some impacts. I mean, I looked at the reefer tender rejection weekly change. Yeah. And I mean, if you look, Savannah, rejection rates are up. Macon, rejection rates are up. Charlotte, Greenville, South Carolina, they're all up.
Mm-hmm.
They're down, and they're up in Lakeland, Florida, Miami, Jacksonville. They're down in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of interesting that you're seeing basically Atlanta pull all of this, any capacity basically in the Southeast into Atlanta to move out. But you would think that there might be some reaction starting in these Southern markets, and you're seeing a little reaction, but it's not doing anything to rates or anything like that yet.
Yeah, it's a very well-supplied area.
Yeah.
Refrigerated this time of year, a lot of domiciled carriers and transportation providers down in the Southeast because of the nature that it's just warmer down here. But, you know, the Northwest last year, very polar opposite situation where there's not a lot of people that are domiciled up there. It's a huge amount of space that needs to be covered.
Yeah.
That just doesn't have a lot of sufficient coverage if you're not ready for it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what happened last year. The Southeast, total opposite, though. A lot of drivers live in the state of Florida.
Yeah.
So produce season doesn't really have a huge impact down there. It just makes it less bad.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I only look at the rejection rates because you're not going to see it show up in volumes or any shift in there. So you, if you can find any positive change in rejection rates, I mean, that's where I would start to look. And like I said, it's relatively soft. I mean, overall, you're seeing the largest market in the area pull all the capacity from all the other ones.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what you would expect in a softer market.
Of regional distribution hub for the area. I mean, for both van and refrigerated.
Yep.
So it's nothing to see here, I guess. Yeah. It's more of the same right now. I want to pull up one more chart. This one helps explain the OTVI versus FMCSA carrier details data here. And this is kind of the chart I used to say, this is why rates are still soft. So if you're looking at this chart, the white line is representative of FMCSA data. Carrier Details is kind enough to do a little bit of extra work on top of this to clean it up a little bit, make it more reflective of total trucking authorities that are active at, you know, at a weekly level. You see the exponential growth through the pandemic and this soft, slow declining period. This index biases to the high side. The OTVI is in the yellow underneath it. And you see capacity's grown 40%. Demand's only up 13%,
yeah.
Versus 5 years ago this time. So 2019 of March. Wow, five years ago. But
crazy. But I mean, I think what this highlights is how slow capacity is to react to any demand side changes. I mean, you look, demand started, spiking in May, June of 2020, and capacity didn't really start growing until, I mean, demand growth peaked in the back half of 2020 in terms of growth from 2019. The capacity side didn't peak until June of 2022. So, I mean, almost 2 years later, and you can see how slow, I mean, you can see when demand really...
So slow.
it that rate of change is why the market has been so soft for so long. Because really, I mean, if you look at the demand side, it's been growing since the beginning of 2023. And if the capacity side was as dynamic to react as the demand side is, you would see rates change a lot faster, or they wouldn't be as low as they are right now, because the market would be more balanced than it currently is.
Yeah, because demand is actually pretty volatile.
Yeah.
You just can't tell. You know, you look at that OTVI increasing up into the right there, that type of increase is unheard of in the pre-COVID world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have had a little bit of a stall out in terms of total authority. You can sort of see it. This is a five-year chart, but over the last 3 weeks, total trucking authorities have actually netted up.
Yeah.
Now, this doesn't mean that we're seeing capacity growing necessarily. Like I said, this index bias is high. But I think we're getting to a point where a lot of the, you know, operators that entered the market, we did some back-end studies on this. A lot of the exits of the new entrants of the last 3 years have dominated.
Yeah.
You know, the people that have come into the market in the last 3 years have dominated a lot of the exits and the revocations over the last several months.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a surprise. I mean, they came into a time when the market was hot. Anybody can make money. Now, they probably weren't the savviest of operators. They just knew that they could make money, make a quick buck. The market flipped. They didn't understand their costs. They don't understand how to operate in a down market. The way I see it, it's churning the people that were in it for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
And I think that's... Ultimately, it's a good thing for the market as a whole. It's just something that needs to happen maybe quicker than it is now. Then the longer it stays this way, the more likely you are to churn out the older entrants, right? Mm-hmm. Those that have withstood previous cycles, but is it worth it now? The longer this plays out.
Yeah, I want to transition this to something that was in the Daily Watch. Sonar subscribers get the Daily Watch. I don't know if you wrote the piece yesterday about durable goods, but there's something in there that's it's good and bad news simultaneously for transportation service providers, centering around durable goods orders and transportation orders, if you will. And this is just, you know, we can pull up this chart here that we have prepped. This is the ACT Research Class 8 orders for trucks. So part of the durable goods orders from the economic sector is transportation, like truck orders, things like that. This is reflecting the Class 8 trucks, the things you see on the Freightliners and Cascadias and all that. You see the Volvos, et cetera, that you see on the road. This is reflective of those orders. And, you know, it's not as high as it's ever been, as you would expect, but it's kind of out of seasonally high, like unseasonably high at this point. And I know Craig has written about how this is not the best indicator to look at economically anymore because of replenishment cycles being off centered and things like that for fleets. But I'm still a little bit combined with the, you know, the operating authorities data and this, I'm kind of like, what's going on?
Yeah, it seems like more people are optimistic and staying in the market longer. I think this is, it's interesting. The, I guess the good news of it is that it didn't spike near as high as it did during 2020 or 2022, which the 2022 increase is interesting. I think that's more of a larger fleet order books at OEMs opened up and they were like, we're still replenishing our equipment, right? But to see this kind of unseasonal pattern, and I'll give a shout out to Michael Rudolph. He wrote that section about
very,
it.
But I mean, very well done.
You saw orders for transportation equipment up 3% month over month. I mean, that is a big increase in orders during a period that shouldn't be, like, typically you don't see orders swell until the back half of the year when order books for the following year open. Right? And that's what's interesting is like you're seeing growth in orders now. And I wonder how much of that is cancellations of equipment. So build slots are opening up in this year and they're like, okay, we're just going to place orders versus, hey, OEMs are opening order books for next year extremely early and you're placing these orders now. So I don't know how much of that plays into it, but it definitely is unseasonal and feels interesting that people are optimistic about the back half of this year.
And that's kind of the thing I'm driving towards here is are we a little high on hopium? You know, we've talked about it here. We expect the market to turn simply because it's been in a down cycle so long.
Yeah.
It has to. Like it's not going to last, kind of like the pandemic. But guess what? That pandemic period of tightness lasted a lot longer than all of us thought it would too.
Yeah.
And you can see by some of the data that we still may have a very long way to go.
Yeah.
And if we're seeing, you know, and again, the Class 8 orders, their bias is towards the larger fleets, larger operations. The ACT used truck 3-year prices are on the floor.
Yeah.
So it's not like we're seeing, I don't know that this is something we can say, oh, all these new owner operators are flooding the market by any means.
Yeah.
This is still a very biased index towards that larger carrier. You know, the Knight Swifts,
the ones that
US Expresses and, you know, Schneiders. That's what this really reflects is their ordering sentiment.
Yeah, and they're making orders. I mean, I think they keep one idea is keep average age young. It keeps maintenance costs low. They're basically churning these orders before they have to do any major maintenance to them. I think the last I heard was between the $500,000 and $600,000 or 500 to 600 thousand mile target to get them off their books. So I think that's some of it. But I think the sentiment from the larger fleets, and I mean they've invested. I mean, look at the chart. I mean, you saw in end of 2022 when the market had clearly started its turn, orders were darn near the highest they've ever been. So I mean, they're going to continue and invest in fleets. It's just the timing of some of this investment's interesting ordering.
Yeah, it feels like we're getting ready for, I mean, because again, that order cycle, orders in February aren't going to get delivered until 2025.
Yeah.
I mean, more than likely.
Yeah, I mean, in the normal pre-COVID, I mean, you were looking 9 to 12 months. It's probably closer to 12 to 15 now. So, I mean, you're talking, even if you get it now, you're talking mid-2025, but when sentiment around the market turning is late 2024, kind of early 2025, you want to have those orders now to be ready to service, have the equipment and service the demand that could be there in a tighter market.
And I think that's what we're seeing.
Yes.
People are expecting a market turn, especially from the transportation provider side. I know a lot of the shipping community also expects things to turn.
Yeah.
We've seen some reports there, but I want to go ahead and, you know, move back in to the, you know, the Baltimore situation, discuss some of the impacts of that. You know, we were talking before the show, and again, freightways.com, a great resource. We're going to cover a few of these stories here today, for those that want to dive a lot deeper into this, that need to follow this, et cetera. But I think we were talking before, it's kind of like, this is a big deal, little deal, this type situation. Like if you're involved in any operating, the automotive sector, of course, very huge. The Port of Baltimore has been heavily reported. If you're involved in the situation, anything, if you have proximity here, it's a huge deal. It's the biggest of deals. If you don't, it doesn't matter. You know,
it's one of those, like, it's important. I mean, it's funny. You hear people talk about, oh, it's sabotage, things like that. It's like, you wouldn't target Baltimore. It's not a huge port. I mean, it's the 12th largest port by container volumes. But when you actually do, like, look at it, the top three ports in the country do 50% of all container imports. So, like, it the imbalance is, it skews to those top five, top eight ports. And then you have, what, I think it's, what, basically 2% of total all container volumes flow through the Port of Baltimore in a year. The other ports are going to be able to handle any influx and diversions. It is a big deal, though, for those, again, the employees at the port, the ones that work in and around, though, I mean,
Drayage, local operators, local carriers, regional carriers.
Yeah, because I think you made a great point in just in conversations that we've had is a lot of the freight that goes out of Baltimore stays fairly regional. I mean, you're talking, what, 30% plus percent stays in Maryland itself?
Yeah, on our tender data volumes, anything originating in the Baltimore market, 36% actually stays within Maryland, 22% goes to Pennsylvania, and 15% goes to Virginia. And then, you know, there's a smattering of, you know,
other things
like New Jersey is, I think, number four or five. So it's a very regional, as you would expect, from a freight distribution, you know, network. Baltimore is not really a big, huge hub for anything, but it, you know, everything that does come there kind of stays with right there.
Yeah, it's more impactful, again, not to container, but automotive imports, because it is the largest, but also coal exports.
Yeah.
And that one's probably the tougher one, is the export.
Yeah, because coal exports. I think, what it was, it some sort of crazy number. I think I have it written down.
It's
here.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite large.
27% of all the coal exports exit through the Port of Baltimore.
Yeah, so that part is going to be the part that's the challenge, right? Yeah. That's going to be the part that's felt and impacted. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, the automotive sector and the roll-on, roll-off...
Row-row.
The exposure that they have.
Yeah.
I mean, there's other ports that can handle, maybe not all of it, and it does create additional costs and things like that. But at the end of the day, that stuff's going to find a home to some degree, at least in the short term, until the port's operational once again.
Yeah, and it's going to take, obviously, several months before the bridge, I mean, probably more than a year before that bridge is repaired, but so probably at least a month before you can get any boats in and out, I think is what we've read here. There's a few articles, Noy Mahoney and John Kingston have both written pieces here. Very good stuff to get some of these details. Noy writes about, you know, the economic impact. You know, we're not going to necessarily see the GDP get really hit by this because it's going to get diverted around the port and it's going to get absorbed into other places. But the port generates nearly $3.3 billion in total personal income and supports 15,330 direct jobs. And then 139,000 jobs are connected to the port, according to state data. So it's not that it's, you know, I don't want to make light. Like that's a lot of people and a lot of, you know, incomes and things like that that really have it fall out here. And the state of Maryland heavily depends on this, like any kind of, you know, hit to their revenue stream. That's a big deal.
Yeah, it is. And I think you can't make light of it because, I mean, obviously, when you have loss of life, tragedy like that, and then, I mean, the impacts that it has, again, to what? Again, 139,000 to, and even if you took it up, I mean, you're talking excess of 150,000 people impacted to some degree. Like, that's no small amount of people. It's, again, it's that big picture, little picture. It's a big deal local. It's to the total U.S. It's probably not a huge deal, but it's there is some impact, level of impact, and there will be some level of disruption. It's just a matter of how big is that disruption and how quickly can it be absorbed in other areas.
Yeah, I think they've targeted, obviously, New Jersey, as well as Savannah, Brunswick, and then there's a few workarounds, smaller facilities that are right around the Baltimore area. But John Kingston writes this article, Baltimore port closure puts truck drivers who haul autos in a bind.
Yeah.
And I think this provides a really good perspective of it's not just about the port operations directly, but those downstream players. He goes on to talk about how there's so much infrastructure.
Yes.
You know, built around, I mean, when you're talking about a niche kind of port system that Baltimore has around the automotive side, mm-hmm. and it's not just automotives, it's equipment, construction equipment. We bring a lot of farm equipment comes in through the Port of Baltimore. And what does that mean in terms of handling that type of like stuff? It's not just containers that are full of, you know, all sorts
consumer
of
goods.
Consumer goods. It's, they need parking lots. And the carriers that haul autos aren't ubiquitous. They're not like just readily available.
Yeah.
So when you divert the automotive traffic into other areas, they don't have regional carriers set up around Savannah necessarily that can haul this additional traffic. And they're talking about how you can't just send these drivers from Baltimore to Savannah either.
It's not. Yeah. It doesn't operate like a normal transportation drive-in network where, I mean, you're moving things. I think the interesting one is like, so for example, say a Volvo, right? Mm-hmm. Big in farm manufacturing, automotive, things like that. It affects them pretty significantly because that's a port that they would use because the infrastructure is built out to handle it. Like, I guarantee you their supply chain and transportation management folks are not there. It's been a challenging week. But I mean, at the end of the day, it's going to move somewhere. And I think it creates, one, it's going to create higher cost in these niche, like auto haulers in Savannah are going to probably see some level of influx in volume. They're going to have some pricing power that they may not have had before. I think the other impact is, what is the rail impact for automotive specifically, right? Because it is a big area. I mean, you would move vehicles from Baltimore to Chicago on a direct line. Now, you have the option, now there's some opportunity to, there will be some spillover. You can move that into, I mean, I know Charleston has a relatively big automotive sector. And I say that because I know BMW uses it.
Greenville.
Yeah. Uses it really heavy. And the last time I was there, you can just see right next to the port, just lines of new cars.
Yeah. Mike Baudendistel before the show earlier today, he's talking about how a lot of these autos, this is mostly European imports that come through the Port of Baltimore. A lot of luxury vehicles. So a lot of high value stuff that comes through the Port of Baltimore. And you can't just do anything with this stuff.
Yeah.
Like the Land Rovers and whatnot. Like they're all represent a lot of money and dollar value. He's our intermodal expert. So he mentioned, you know, the Howard Street Bridge there in Baltimore really inhibits the intermodal volume in this market.
Yeah. The height of it's too low to double stack containers. And I think they're going through a process to actually increase the height of the tunnels.
Yeah, it's not supposed to be done to 2027.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not a, we can't, it's not a relief valve or something like that. And you look at outbound intermodal volume out of Baltimore, it's like what?
Oh,
it's a tenth of a percent of total rail volume. So it's not really, it's the impact's there. I think the auto side, again, is going to be the side that autos and construction equipment and farming equipment that flow, that use that as kind of their lifeline into the U.S. Because, I mean, really, when you think about it, Port of New York, New Jersey, Port of Savannah, Port of Charleston, I mean, really, the Norfolk, right? Mm-hmm. They're all really exposed to containers as opposed to these other more niche that Baltimore built itself up to that. Now it's been, you've got to be able to flex one way. This is where having some flexibility and efficiency, because this is something that will create inefficiencies, but if you can adjust to it rather quickly, you should see, I don't say, I mean, fairly limited impacts. There will be cost and time associated with this, but in the longer term, you should be able to see it, see some ability to flex.
I want to pull up one more chart real quick if we have it. We may not have it. The outbound tender market share. Yeah, there we go. It's not totally complete here, but it's I chopped off the last part. Well, outbound tender market share value for total tender volumes in the relative to the United States, Baltimore has actually been in a free fall. It's actually 1.2% of the total outbound market share, but this is after it's been kind of elevated. And then you have Savannah down there, which has also been falling down to about 0.89% of total outbound market share. So we're in two markets now that were already kind of had a hot moment, and now they're kind of crawling out of it.
Yep.
So I don't know that it's going to have a huge impact to capacity down there.
Not on a nationwide scale, I don't think. Yeah. I mean, again, there's going to be some positive boost, but is it enough to really affect things on a national scale? It sure doesn't feel that way.